rattling, tins dropping, perhaps some nice smells of old digestive biscuits. The moment of epiphany occurred in 1963 when Robert was 16. He had gone to Scotland with his parents, who were attending a meeting of the British Association for the Advancement of Science in Aberdeen. His father was president of the anthropological section and was giving a paper. After it was over, young Robert decided to go further up to the north of Scotland to visit a school friend. He had to overnight in Inverness and found as he wandered around that there was nowhere to eat, which was typical of most places in Scotland on a Sunday in those days, or of most of provincial Britain for that matter. He ended up back at the railway station, where he found a vending machine and purchased a packet of Rowntree's Munchies and some McVitie and Price's Ginger Nuts. Back in his hotel room, he opened the packet of Munchies, and it suddenly dawned on me that were I to throw away the wrapper, a small fragment of history would be discarded. Today, he still has those packets, but more importantly, he realised that here was a vast subject that was disappearing unrecorded, and so began a lifetime's passion. Now, why did he do that, as a young lad of 16? What made him have those thoughts? Why was his passion not revolving round, say, football, which is what I was thinking about aged 16? According to the poet Philip Larkin, your parents don't necessarily always help you out. In the case of Robert Opie, and I suspect the majority of people, you do in fact owe a great deal to your parents, most of it positive, although you might not be aware of it or feel grateful at the time. His parents, Peter and Iona Opie, were pioneers in the field of folklore, studying nursery rhymes, singing games and children's verse, and became experts known in social and academic circles around the world. They were keen collectors because, of course, you don't just have to gather physical objects to be a collector. You can collect oral history, songs, or, in the case of Sigmund Freud, jokes. As a small boy, Robert had started collecting the usual sort of things that children do, such as stamps, coins, and stones. The matchbox die-cast toy models from Lesney were another collection, and his father encouraged him to date each box as it was acquired. Collecting is an instinctive thing within our human psyche. In my case, that instinct was helped by my surroundings. I thought every home had its own little museum. Most people who collect in childhood, as I did, give up in their teenage years, distracted by other foolish things. But Robert kept on. He never stopped. At boarding school at Ardingly in Sussex, he gradually moved on from adhesive stamps to the Cinderella world of philately that included postal stationery, stamp booklets and greetings telegrams. Instinctively, he wanted to collect something that others didn't. Stamp collectors tend to begin by saving everything because it's all new to you. Then gradually they realise that the task is overwhelming, so the obvious thing to do is concentrate on one country, then one reign, and then finally specialise on one scarce issue. They end up narrowing it down so much that only one other person has the same interest, and they live in Australia. My thinking has always been the opposite. As my interest in our consumer world developed, I wanted to put everything into context, which meant looking at an increasingly bigger picture. To begin with, it was all about saving the contemporary material around me. It was a few years before I realised it was even possible to discover earlier items. After all, why would anyone have saved a bird's-eye fish finger pack from the 1950s or a Force cereal box from the 1920s? Robert did his A-levels, and at 18 went to Portsmouth to do an HND in business studies. Why not a proper university, studying some traditional subject? After all, he'd gone to a well-known public school, the sort that sent its pupils to the better-class universities. "I really don't know," he said, pausing, staring at me through his spectacles. His accent is clipped middle class, very fluent, with a great flow, a good way with words and images, and most people would take him for a product of Oxbridge, not a provincial poly. I can't remember how it happened. Business studies was a new thing in the 60s. I just decided I wanted to try it, and someone suggested Portsmouth. While at Portsmouth, he discovered the exciting world of CTNs, confectioners, tobacconists, and newsagents. He visited as many as possible every fortnight, asking them for any dummy packages, posters, or point-of-sale items that they might be chucking out. As it turned out, this was the last era of the much-admired shop window display, with its intricate displays of boxes of chocolates, with contents that looked like the real thing. After he finished his diploma, he started work with a market research company in London, and stayed in market research, full-time, for the next 16 years. But that was not his passion. That was work. Now he was aware that at antique markets and in places like the Portobello Road, it was possible to find earlier examples of packaging and advertising. He still saved every piece of contemporary packaging that came his way. But now he was seeking out earlier examples, going back to Victorian times. The term collector tends to be a rather nebulous description. I see myself as a recorder of the recent past, a consumer historian. I am gathering the evidence of how society has been transformed by this extraordinary consumer revolution. To do that properly, I have to save enough material to put that massive story into order. And it seems that this task will go on forever. Gradually, he acquired thousands, then tens of thousands, of packages and wrappings, tins and boxes, till they were taking over his whole house, his whole life. I remember when I was still a keen philatelist and had joined the Royal Philatelic Society, I gave a lecture to the members called A Load of Rubbish. The idea was to show how packaging and other ephemera was just as important and as relevant to save as stamps. They all have a design and social history and are equally part of our throwaway society. So I made comparisons between my varieties of postal stationery and the 57 varieties of Heinz Baked Beans labels. Indeed, they were all throwaway items as are stamps. They are part of our history, with fascinating designs and graphics and artwork. These labels are just as worthy of collecting as stamps. Not better, not worse, just as important. Robert Opie and his passion for packaging received national recognition in 1975 when he exhibited some 3,000 items at the V&A in London. The Pack Age, A Century of Wrapping It Up, was open for 7 weeks. Actually, it received international attention. There was coverage in magazines, TV and radio all over the world. Some 80,000 people came to see the exhibition. At one time, there were so many in the museum that they had to close the front doors. Mind you, there happened to be a Wombles exhibition on at the same time. Even so, the reaction was amazing. I did much of the PR myself, sitting in a cubicle at the V&A and ringing the newspapers. The public loved it, including the museum guards on duty, who became animated and were reminiscing along with everyone else. Visitors made lots of animated comments about how it should be on permanent display. That, of course, was his end goal. And he hoped the V&A attention would help make it happen. Alas, it didn't. For almost the next 10 years he carried on with his day job, hoping someone or some organisation would come forward and offer to finance or sponsor some sort of permanent exhibition. I gave a talk at a J. Walter Thompson client evening, created a display for NatWest Bank at their Port Talbot branch, and presented a museum proposal to senior management at Metalbox, one of the biggest packaging manufacturers at the time. As expected, everyone expressed interest, but no support was forthcoming. Eventually, the time came to go it alone. And with two others, and a bank loan, the Museum of Advertising and Packaging opened in 1984. British Waterways allowed him to have the ground floor of a disused warehouse in the inland docks of Gloucester. In the first year, he attracted crowds of 29,000, which grew to 57,000 within 6 years. in 1993. Some of his collection went on tour in Japan as The Treasures and Pleasures of Childhood. From 1999, for 6 years, the Museum of Memories was open, funded by Wigan Council. Visitor numbers began to decline in 1991. There was a credit squeeze, and then Sunday trading meant people went to Tesco instead of a museum visit. National museums stopped charging in 1997, and the lottery took a lot of loose change out of the economy. But perhaps the biggest difference was that during the 1990s, the number of attractions doubled. Despite all of this, our museum attendance held up at around 30,000. However, in 2001, the lease was up, and the search was on for a new venue. By now, they were pretty well known, and had offers of new sites from Cumbria to Cornwall. Several bodies offered free premises, promised to pay start-up costs, but they were never quite in viable locations. A place like Bath already has enough museums, and visitors from London would often say, "We should be there," and I would say, "No way, there are already enough attractions there." As it happened, the best offer with the chance of backing came from London, thanks to the design and branding company PI Global. They were moving out of their premises to ones next door, and were able to help with fundraising and a support network. Having failed to gain start-up funding from the Heritage Lottery Fund, the next step was to approach possible brand owners for support. And fortunately, some big names came forward in the form of Cadbury's, Kellogg's, Twinings, McVitie's, Vodafone and Diageo, makers of Guinness and Johnny Walker. The Museum of Brands, Packaging and Advertising opened in Notting Hill in December 2005. How could I have missed it? Well, I suppose London is a big place with so many competing museums. In Gloucester, it had been a star attraction, attracting attention and publicity out of proportion to its size. Also, the thing with time is that it gets concertinaed. I could have sworn I read an article about the Packaging Museum in Gloucester only the other month, or could it have been last year? Anyway, not all that long ago, surely. So it had become imprinted on my brain that it must still be there. So what's it like? Well, it is a bit hard to find. I don't know Notting Hill apart from Portobello Road, which I have been visiting for over 40 years looking for treasures, rarely with much success in recent years, as it seems to be full of rich Italians being ripped off with repro antiques. I found Colville Terrace, but Colville Mews, where the museum is situated, is actually off Lonsdale Road. I entered Lonsdale Road halfway down, not knowing whether to turn right or left into it, so asked a council worker cleaning a lamppost. "What museum? Never seen no museum round here." I said it was in a mews, and he said, "Oh, try that way, there is a mews down there." When I eventually found Colville Mews, there was a little gaily coloured sign on the corner indicating the right direction. Outside what I assumed was the entrance, there was a crowd of about 20 or 30 young people standing around chattering, students by the look of them, international sort by the sound of their voices. London is full of language schools these days, so perhaps there is one next door. But no, when the doors of the museum opened, all the students made a mad rush forward. The entrance was a delightful surprise, all new and gleaming, very slick and well-appointed, with a pine-tabled coffee bar, interesting-looking bookstall and, of course, lots of attractive displays of vintage boxes and packaging. I'm not sure why, but I thought it might be dusty and decaying, which is how you tend to think of old packaging. But it is in a brand-new building, recently and rather lavishly equipped. The girl on the till said, "Just start here, to the left of the till. Wander round, it's all in chronological order, you won't get lost." I have been in too many museums where they have said that, and even when I've finished, I'm still not clear which was the right way round. But this was totally clear, with rooms in order, the periods clear, and all beautifully laid out. It was the neat arrangement of everything that rather stunned me. How on earth did he do it? My own modest 20 or so little collections are in a permanent mess, however much I try to organise some sort of cataloguing system. It often starts with some sort of logic, then goes potty. For example, my football postcards. Originally, I had one album with named teams and players, followed by unnamed teams. Then, I started collecting single footballers, pairs of footballers, teams in unusual formations, lined up in the goal mouth as opposed to in three rows, as nature and football photographers have ordained. Then came comic football cards, birthday cards, plus, of course, foreign teams. They are now at a stage where I can never find what I'm looking for, yet I probably have only 500 football postcards in all. But dear God, Robert Opie has over 500,000 items in his collection. Only 12,500 of them are currently on show in his museum. Only? How did he cope with creating any sort of order? The answer, as I soon found, is that for two-thirds of the museum, everything is in strict chronological order, starting with the Victorian Age, then Edwardian, First World War, 20s, 30s, Second World War, 40s, 50s, 60s, and so on, in decades right up to the present day. The museum tells the extraordinary story of culture and the consumer revolution, the changing styles of packaging and promotion, the ceaseless arrival of new brands, and the constant innovation and inventiveness that have catapulted our lifestyles into the comparative ease of leisure time. Time enough to visit a museum or two. It is a story of mass manufacture and mass communication, which have changed every detail of daily living. As visitors travel through the 150-year time tunnel, each comes to that point where history leaps worryingly into nostalgia. Toys become childhood memories, and a bag of Rancheros crisps triggers a school day vision from the dim and distant past. Suddenly, your personal moments are on display, and you join the story of the consumer revolution from that moment on. Each period is in its own gallery, clearly labelled, but instead of just lumping all his Victorian items into rows of glass cases, any old how, he has attempted to create separate tableaux, such as the Great Exhibition of 1851, which has a case of its own. There are special displays showing fashion items, such as knitting patterns, advertisements for women's clothes, and including some genuine 1920s flapper dresses draped over mannequins. Naturally, most of the stuff does consist of packaging, boxes, tins, containers, wrappers, everything from biscuits to boot polish. Each period follows a similar style, with special displays containing real objects, such as a 50s fridge and cooker, along with contemporary boxes of soap powder or washing-up liquid. Throughout, I was astounded by the condition of every single item. You could believe they were all fakes or mock-ups, as the colours are so strong. Everything is so uncreased, untorn, unmarked. I've always told myself that I don't actually care much about the condition of my stuff as long as I can read the writing. But I could see there's a lot to be said for always having the best example you can find or afford. The trouble he must have gone to, demoting his poorer examples to the ranks when he got a genuine officer-class example worthy of display. Around 90% of the items were new to me, in that I'd never seen them in the flesh before, only in books. Even when I got onto the two world wars, periods I think I do know something about, and have lots of items in my collections, he still had masses of stuff I'd never seen, let alone acquired. In his Second World War gallery there was a poster, totally new to me, reading, "Hitler will send no warning, so always carry your gas mask." As I was walked round, I got more and more depressed. I began thinking, why do I bother? I'm just messing about, faffing around. I've got nothing worth keeping, far less displaying. Might as well give up now. There was a girl behind me, going as slowly as me, examining every display, who turned out to be Italian. I asked her to take my photo standing in front of the Hitler poster. I do have an original wartime gas mask, so it would look good beside it. She then asked me to take her photo in front of various objects she particularly liked. She was one of the students who had arrived at the same time as me. Most had zoomed ahead, probably in the cafe by now, or outside having a fag, but several had lingered in each room as I had done. I later met up with the group's leader, who said they were all from the Istituto Marangoni, Italy's oldest fashion college, founded 1930. "You've come a long way," I replied, but it turned out they have a campus in London's East End, in Fashion Street. When I got to the 60s, I came to two cases devoted to subjects I do know very well, the 1966 World Cup and the Beatles. Each display was quite modest, and he didn't have as much as I have on either subject, thank God for that. But how could he? He is trying to cover several hundred topics. He had a Beatles cloth I'd never seen before, and his yellow submarine toy was in gleaming condition and in its original box, whereas mine is bashed and the conning tower is missing. In his Wembley case, he only had a semi-final ticket, not the final, and his programme was the souvenir one, very easy to get, not the programme for the final between England and West Germany. That did cheer me up. In the final third of the museum, the remaining galleries dispense with strict chronology and are devoted to individual brands, such as Cadbury's Milk Tray or Guinness, over the last 100-plus years, so you have old and new items together and can see the progression and advances. It's a good way to end, pointing up that it's not just a gallery of old rubbish, packets normally thrown away, but a gallery of history, of social and economic change and development through the ages. Robert had been busy all morning, so it was only after I had finished my tour on my own that I was able to sit down and talk to him about what I had seen. We sat in the coffee bar first, but behind us was a vintage TV, which was showing old commercials from the 50s. Amusing, first time round, but the noise was getting on my nerves, so I asked if he had a quieter place. So we went upstairs to their conference room and had our talk. The museum is now registered as a charity, and they are self-supporting, living on admission fees and a percentage of the books and items sold in their shop. The annual number of visitors is much the same as it was in Gloucester, at around 30,000 a year. We didn't have the same competition as we now have in London, but nevertheless, our visitor numbers continue to grow. I raved about his museum, the items, the arrangement, and said how it struck me that in the early periods, especially the Victorian and Edwardian, the packaging was so much more artistic, decorative, the design and lettering better and of higher quality. As the decades have gone on, it seems to have got worse, cheaper, thinner, poorer. Or perhaps I was looking through rose-coloured specs, nostalgic for decades I never knew, never experienced, but found attractive partly because they were old. This always does tend to lend a patina, making items seem better and more interesting than the recent or modern. But everyone must agree that Victorian biscuit boxes are miles more attractive than those boring packets of surf washing powder from the 70s with their crude colours and lettering. Robert did not quite agree. He rather likes 1970s soap powders, especially the own brands produced for the supermarkets. He has written about 20 books, all related to product packaging or social history, many of which are on sale in the shop, but like his parents, he hasn't made a lot of money from his writing. Like me, he is a member of the Ephemera Society and goes to their fairs, and also to the Bloomsbury postcard fairs, but he does not attend football programme fairs, as he has no specific interest in football, except when it crosses over into packaging like World Cup Willy sweets and toys. So what's the most he's ever spent? He had to think. It probably wasn't a piece of packaging, but a poster, which can sometimes go for over £1,000, particularly those Art Deco ones from the 1920s. They can be a huge expense for him. Mostly, he has not paid more than £100 for things, and often just a few pounds. He doesn't sell things, despite often being hard up. He would rather just keep the duplicates, because quite often they are needed for other exhibitions or for recreating period shop windows, when a number of the same objects helps to give the right effect. I still get a great buzz from an item coming in that I didn't know existed, particularly if it helps me to understand something better. The collection is rather like some limitless jigsaw, and all the time I'm trying to see the picture, endlessly fitting the pieces together until the picture becomes clearer and makes more sense. And there seems to be no limit to the material. When people go round the exhibition, many visitors say to me afterwards, "You must be so proud having done all this." And I guess that's so, but actually, I'm looking around at the things that need to be improved, or where something should be added to make the story work better. People used to think I was nuts, and some may still think that, but once they've actually been to the museum, then they understand. I feel the need to explain and celebrate the packaging and marketing story, and raise the status of a much misunderstood industry. I see what I'm doing almost as a duty. No one ever says thank you to the packaging industry, and yet this museum is as important as any art gallery, science museum, or natural history museum. But why should they? Okay, the material might be pretty and attractive, and reflect our social and economic history, but basically it is just rubbish, stuff made to be chucked away. And in this age, we are being encouraged all the time to avoid waste, to save resources so we can save the planet. Packaging is now seen as one of the public enemies in environmental and green circles. Yes, I now hear that argument a lot, which makes me even more determined to help the understanding. What people don't realise is how much we owe to packaging. Packaging saves waste. In the old days, half of fresh items that travelled any distance had to be chucked away, as they'd gone bad or got bashed. Now that was a terrible waste. Packaging preserves the contents, keeps them safe and fresh, helps you use the product wisely, tells you what's inside, and so on. To give you one example, a cucumber will have an extended shelf life of 14 days just by using 1.5 grams of plastic film. But why do certain items, like, say, those posh Belgian dark chocolate biscuits whose name escapes me, have to come in three layers of heavy-duty plastic, which takes forever to open and puts up the price? "Surely you wouldn't want your biscuits to be broken," he said. "Oh, I wouldn't mind the odd one," I replied, "if the price was a lot lower. Anyway, I personally now stopped buying those biscuits, much though I liked them, purely on principle, as they really annoy me. However, I do enjoy the pleasure of having raspberries and blueberries all the year round, which I buy from street markets, which I realise come thousands of miles and have to be encased in little plastic boxes, otherwise they wouldn't make it. On the other hand, my wife refuses to buy items out of season, such as daffs and tulips at Christmas time. She says there's no need for it. She prefers to wait for things in season, as we all had to in the olden days, before the age of cheap transport and clever packaging. Even now, when he's already assembled more than enough stuff to fill several museums, Robert is still on the lookout. When he goes to the supermarket for his weekly shopping, he always looks for interesting new products, whether he himself needs them or not. Obviously, I have to make instant choices. A supermarket might have 30,000 different items with new ones coming in all the time, but with wisdom and knowledge based on hindsight, I now tend to know what is worth saving. For example, yesterday I bought a packet of Ariel, even though I have more than enough soap powder to last me a lifetime. It was the first time I'd seen a claim for "save up to 40p in energy with this pack by turning to cool wash." This is an example of the environmentally aware save the planet world in which we now live, so that was interesting. I now look back over 45 years and realise there were innovations I missed or was not aware of. Hopefully most of the time I've got things right, like buying the first plastic milk bottle, which arrived in 1971 when milk was 6.5p a pint. Sometimes he gets to the checkout before realising he has not bought anything for himself to eat, so he has to go back and think, "What's for dinner?" As yet, Robert has not married. Although some of his girlfriends have understood his collecting passion, he's never taken the leap. Perhaps there has been that concern that the time might arrive when a wife might say, "Either your collection goes, or I do." Did he feel fulfilled then, not having a family? Doing something so different from most other people has meant that Plan A was not necessarily going to work out. But I've been incredibly fortunate to have found something so utterly absorbing, and something that has been needed as a resource for the nation. It's just taken a lot longer than I ever thought it would. Yes, I do feel fulfilled. I'm always busy, never bored. There are enough books to write to last me another 3 lifetimes. I'm always travelling to different places, meeting new people, talking to groups and associations, being interviewed on radio or television. But then I'm thinking I must press on. There's so much more to be done. So, with no children to inherit his museum, what will happen in the future? Having made the museum itself into a charity, he is now working on turning over all the contents, as well as his own, into the care of a charitable trust. This will ensure the museum continues. His museum certainly deserves to succeed. It's not just a collection of old tat, gathered willy-nilly, shoved into any old order, as with many museums and collections around the country. He has a clear, cold, logical mind, rather scientific. I don't see him as at all potty or crazy for devoting his life to packaging, though personally I would never think of sacrificing my marital or family life for my collections. All the museum creators and curators I met on my travels had different reasons for doing what they do, from the commercial to the cultural, from escapism to self-promotion, but Robert Opie was about the only person who was inspired by a sense of duty, who seemed to see himself as almost on a religious crusade, with talk of principles and sacrifices. Has he had self-doubts? Not, apparently, since the age of 16, when he first saw the light and settled on his path. How could I ever compete, identify an area no one else had bothered with, build up such an extraordinary collection, then create a unique museum? I found his museum totally wonderful, fascinating, awe-inspiring. And he himself is a remarkable man. I felt humbled in his presence. The Museum of Brands, Packaging and Advertising, 2 Colville Mews, Lonsdale Road, Notting Hill, London W11, 2AR. Telephone 0207 908 0880. www.museumofbrands.com. Conclusion. So am I going to open my own museum? And if so, where and when and how, and most of all, why? Talking to all those people made me realise that there are many and varied reasons why people open museums. It's not just simply the obvious motivation, they have collected some quite nice stuff that they would like others to see and enjoy. That's vanity museuming, a little known branch of vanity publishing. Some do it, like Robert Opie, as a cause, almost as if it were a religious calling, showing the zeal and devotion of a true worshipper, not for their own ego and glory, but for the greater good of humanity. They feel it has to be done, even at the cost of their own relationships, or lack of them. I'm not saying that Robert has not married because of his passion for packaging, as it would be impudent to presume such a thing, but there must surely be a connection. Some do it to express themselves as an art form, a piece of creativity they find unable to achieve in their normal working lives, such as Peter Nelson, the dentist who collected all those cars of the stars. Others use it as an escape, to distract themselves from something upsetting or tragic that has happened in their lives, such as the death of 2 babies in the case of Helene and the Fan Museum. Some have fallen into museums by chance, like the Bests at the Casbah, inheriting a house that had interesting connections, or Mike Parrish and his secret bunker, which just happened to get built on his land. But some people are true obsessives, who from their earliest childhood consciousness have been fascinated by the insides of old wirelesses or old chocolate wrappers, and the obsession never leaves them. With a few of them, it is clear that there is a commercial motive, that a product is in some way being pushed, as in the Pencil Museum, which is not to suggest it is just a money-grabbing operation, but it is a spin-off from the pencil factory and is seen as a source of income and also publicity. The Bank of Scotland's excellent money museum is not at all money-making, as entrance is free, but it is clearly image-making, raising the profile of the bank, making us all feel good about them. The money museum is unusual in that it doesn't have to make money, which all the others have got to do to a greater or lesser extent, regardless of how big and famous and successful they appear to have become, as with the National Football Museum. There is some good news there since I visited. Not only is the move to Manchester assured, but it looks as if there is a good chance they could keep some sort of presence in Preston after all. They would then have two museums in different locations, a football version of the Tate Modern in London and Tate Liverpool. But there is some bad news about the sheep centre at Cockermouth. Roy Campbell, the owner, did hint at the end that he had begun to realise that commercially he would be much better off with hotel bedrooms than sheep on stage. Hence, he had applied for planning permission to extend his hotel. Not long after I visited, there was a disaster, but not another animal one like Foot and Mouth, which he had been dreading. In November 2009, Cumbria was devastated by the worst floods for 1,000 years, and the little town of Cockermouth suffered some of the worst damage, with flood water up to 8 feet deep along the main street, which happens to be called Main Street, much to the confusion of the TV reporters when they first landed, most of them not knowing where they were. The sheep centre, being just outside the town, well away from the river, immediately became a place of refuge. Around 100 people, including some of their own staff, who had been rescued by the police, fire, ambulance and other services, many from the roofs of their homes by helicopters, found themselves camping there. Good job it was there, a modern, warm, spacious structure just minutes from the devastated town. Mattresses were laid out in what was normally the souvenir shop, while the theatre next door, where the sheep show was staged, was filled with clothes. From all over the country and abroad, people had sent clothes, many of them brand new, to help the flood victims. People slept and lived in the sheep centre for up to 6 days before they were found other accommodation. For most of them, it will be up to a year before they can return to their normal homes. Roy decided not to reopen the sheep show in the spring, as he had been doing for all those years. This decision was not connected with the floods, though of course attendance would have been badly affected with so many bridges down and roads still closed. His planning permission had come through. In 2010, work was due to begin on converting the sheep centre into hotel bedrooms. So that chapter has now to be read as a record, an account of what once was an unusual and fascinating live museum. You never know. Someone might attempt a similar venture once they read about it. Anyway, please don't go there hoping to see sheep on a stage, only if you want a bed for the night. Let's hope all of my other museums survive, at least for a good many more years. I know Cockermouth well, because for the last 24 years we have spent half of each year at Lowswater, 7 miles away. There was flooding there as well, and our house was left isolated, an island in a sea of flood water. But as we are on a slight hillock, we were not directly affected. But our next-door neighbours got flooded out. As I write, they are living in our house. It will take up to 6 months before their house is habitable again. Because I know Cockermouth so well, it suddenly came to me during my journey that it would be the perfect place to have my own little museum. I had realised by then that museums could be anything, big and important and purpose-built, or small and situated in the bedroom of your council house. Most of all, they can be anywhere. Cockermouth already has many antique and second-hand shops, book places and galleries. Premises are quite cheap compared with London. And then what seemed to clinch it was telling my brother about my plan. instead of saying, "How daft, how stupid, how can you contemplate such a thing when you live half of each year in London?" he said, "Great, I'll run it for you." He lives in Carlisle. His own family is grown up, and he's recently retired. A little toddle out to Cockermouth each day would quite suit him. I've always fancied being a museum curator, which was news to me. In my mind's eye, I saw all my collections being given their own little space and display, perhaps even their own room, if I could find a place big enough. It would go against one of the principles of my mad museums, which is a museum devoted to just one topic, but it would be the collections of just one person, like a working man's version of the wonderful Sir John Soane's museum. But would people come? Cockermouth, for all its attractions, is not a tourist trap town like Keswick or Grasmere, or anything like the size of Bath or Edinburgh, which are museum magnets. When local people, or the odd passing tourist, had visited my museum once, why would they want to come back? What's so special about my stuff, anyway? Would the world and his wife really want to trail to Cockermouth to see my suffragette postcards, my used tax discs, wartime ration books, lottery tickets, old newspapers, ancient children's books? I say, I have 20 or so different collections at least, which is true. But if pressed, I have to admit there are only two areas where my stuff is better than half-decent. Then I thought, why do I want to do this anyway? What are my reasons? I don't fit any of the types or patterns I've listed. It wouldn't be for commercial reasons, as a crusade, or an escape from some tragedy. I would be doing it partly for vanity, showing off, which would surely rebound when people saw how pathetic most of my stuff is. On the other hand, why can't ordinary collectors have their chance in the sun? I'd already been thinking, lying awake at night, that when I came to do the marketing and publicity, I would stress the ordinary, Mr. Pooterish nature of my treasures. There is, in fact, nothing wrong with vanity, not when it comes to creating a museum. It is always an important element. You have to believe that your stuff, which you have personally collected, is worthy of display, because, after all, you have spent such time and thought and energy acquiring it. More than vanity, was it also an attempt at immortality? Possibly. But then, isn't that the nature of all museums, all collections? You collect in order to conserve, protect, and you hope that what you've gathered will be kept together, proof of who you were, your legacy to posterity. Collecting is the ultimate vanity, believing you can instill order, create something that will last forever. I know in my case this is pure foolish fantasy. When I pop it, the first thing my wife will say is, "Off to the skip." Neither she nor any of my children has any interest in my treasures, so they will dump any stuff still left in my room, get rid of it however they can. Multimillionaires with proper collections are, of course, different, and their treasures are desired. When they donate items to our famous galleries and museums, they are very keen to have them displayed in the Joe Bloggs wing or the Joe Bloggs gallery. Not for themselves, they say, but it will please Mrs. Joe Bloggs and all the little Bloggses to come. Opening my own little museum would be a form of vanity, ensuring my stuff got its own little show. But most of all, it would have to be fun. That would really be my main and only real motivation. As I lay awake, planning the opening, I began to try to analyse where the fun would actually be. After the first few months I would grow bored. I always do, after the first flush of most excitements. I have so many other things in my life. Such as work. Oh yes, I hope I have a few more years turning out the old words. Then there's my lovely family, 4 grandchildren, and all that football to watch. And God, I almost forgot, this museum idea has come out of my collecting, but I want my collecting to go on, and on, and on. I need as much time for that as possible. The hunt is the best fun for me, not the displaying. In fact, in my own house I have drawers full of stuff I haven't looked at since I bought it. So, After about a week turning it all over, I decided I was being mad, self-deluded, potty. I'd allowed my brother Johnny to get quite keen, which I should not have done. When I told him I'd changed my mind, he was a bit disappointed. In thinking seriously about what I might have to show, it's really only my Beatles stuff that is of any interest, plus a bit of the football stuff. And many years ago, I'd already made plans for my best Beatles stuff. This consists of 10 or so original lyrics of some of their songs, written by Paul and John. When I was doing their biography all those years ago, I would be sitting in Abbey Road at the end of the evening session and see scraps of paper lying around, on which they had drafted their songs. They were being left for the cleaners to burn. Now and again, if I wanted to use the exact words in a chapter I was doing, I would ask if I could have them. They said, yes, of course, take them. They'd recorded the song. Why would they want to keep these scraps of paper? I shoved them in a drawer at home for about 10 years, when suddenly places like Sotheby's started selling Beatles memorabilia. I woke up one day in 1978 and realised that the 10 scraps I had were worth more than my house. I offered them to the British Museum, and in turn they went into the manuscript room of the British Library when it opened. They are classified as being on permanent loan, as I was never quite sure what I might eventually do with them. Not put them in my own museum is the answer, which is why I have now written my will, leaving them to the British Library. When I heard in the spring of 2010 that the Abbey Road studios where the Beatles used to perform might be taken over by the National Trust, and part of it at least become a museum open to the public, I offered them the rest of my Beatles memorabilia. The National Trust said they would love it, if and when it ever comes to pass. Let's hope it does. In the last few weeks, I've also decided to offer something to the National Football Museum when it reopens. My football stuff is hardly unique, though I like to think I've got most of the classic books on football dating back to the 1890s, and so has the Football Museum. But I have one book they don't have and might want, a modern one, a monster book about the size of a small car, which is called The Manchester United Opus, signed by Sir Alex Ferguson and Sir Bobby Charlton. So, while I won't have my own museum, which was a really silly idea, I am going to have the quiet pleasure of knowing that 2 national museums, perhaps 3, will have some of my stuff. My name will not be on them, and I won't even care if they shove things away in a storage room. I'll be in a museum, without all the faff of actually having a museum. I can die happy. Hunter Davis, March 2010. That is the end of Behind the Scenes at the Museum of Baked Beans. It was written by Hunter Davis and read by Richard Burnip. This has been an ISIS audiobooks presentation. For further details of our extensive catalogue of audiobooks on cassette, CD and MP3, please call our free phone number 0800 731 5637 or visit our website www.isis-publishing.co.uk.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this programme.